across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. They're still arguing about it this morning. The Remainers in chief have risen from their slumber to try and kill off once and for all any chance of leaving the European Union in the way that the government wants to. Five former prime ministers have all joined forces now to tell us what a terrible idea it all is, how breaking international law will change forever our respect and standing in the world, and why we must bow to our EU masters when it comes to our own lands and our own products. Well, thanks, but no thanks, guys. The Guardian this morning is up to its old tricks as well. Another top secret report has been unearthed that warns of more thousands of lorries being stuck on more roads in Kent. And without a hint of irony, they then report that cases of anxiety have trebled in a decade. Could there by any chance be a connection? After telling people to be afraid of everything for years, they're now saying, apparently, there's a bit of anxiety in the world. I don't know what to do about that. I'll tell you what I'll do. We'll think about it later. Put it over there. There we are. That's a special one for the Guardian's media correspondent, who seems to be obsessed with the fact that I keep tearing up the Guardian. Well, I don't keep tearing it up. They keep printing rubbish, though. I don't know why. Coming up, of course, we'll be talking to Stuart Jackson, who is the former special advisor to Brexit Secretary David Davis. 0344 499 1000 is the number. Coming up, we'll also be checking in with our favourite Northern Ireland security specialist, Colin Breen. He'll tell us why the EU is playing fast and loose with the terror threat in the region. And travel guru Simon Calder will also be here to explain why the rules around duty-free shopping are about to change for the better. And we'll be talking to Professor Carol Sikora, who's been good enough to join us from his holidays to explain why the COVID testing programme doesn't seem to be working as well as it should, but also to tell us what we can do to stop being frightened of the virus. We spoke a lot about this yesterday, about how this rule of six business is probably not going to be obeyed by most people in this country, but also what the government needs to do to make sure that people are actually confident enough to go out, confident enough to go back to work, confident enough to use public transport, and confident enough to get the economy moving again. 0344 499 1000. Also, in the last hour, I'll be asking this question. Have you turned to drink in the lockdown? According to a new study from the Royal College of Psychiatrists, the number of problem drinkers in the country has doubled to over 8 million since March. There's a little quiz that you can take in the Daily Mail. I've taken it this morning. I'll be telling you precisely what the result of that was. But as ever, of course, we want to hear from you. Your thoughts, your opinions, your experiences, they're all part of the rich tapestry of common sense that we will weave over the next 3 hours. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on the fastest growing radio station on the planet. It is, of course, Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, some of you will have witnessed yesterday's kind of pantomime in the House of Commons, where basically Alok Sharma was due to get up and make the case for Boris Johnson's new internal reports, its bill, which basically supposedly, potentially, breaks international law, depending on who you speak to. It turns out that Boris Johnson himself decided it would be a good idea for him to actually present the bill for its first reading. And instead of then changing up and not putting Ed Miliband in the chair, they decided to put Ed Miliband in the chair, despite the fact that he's the opposite number of Alok Sharma. They should have, surely, because Keir Starmer wasn't able to attend, thanks to him having to self-isolate because somebody in his household may have coronavirus. Why didn't they put Angela Rayner up? Are they ashamed of Angela Rayner? Are they frightened of Angela Rayner? Is the Labour Party so sexist that they can't have a woman actually represent them as the leader of the party? If I was Angela Rayner right now, I'd be pretty cheesed off. In fact, I might even consider stepping down as the deputy to Keir Starmer. Because what is the point of being deputy leader of the party if, when the leader of the party isn't able to attend the House of Commons because of illness, you don't get to substitute for him? Can you imagine the conversation? Ed Miliband, yesterday's man, a bloke who all the Labourites think did a fantastic job. By the way, the bill went through completely without any problems whatsoever. And so whatever Ed Miliband had to say, nobody took any notice of, as usual. But if you're Angela Rayner, you'd have to be sitting there going, what is the point of this? Why am I bothering? Why am I taking all this heat? Why am I being the subject of scrutiny? Why are people being critical of me because of the clothes that I wear? And in fact, whenever I get the opportunity to speak on behalf of the party, they don't let me. They've got a real problem with women in the Labour Party, haven't they? 0344 499 1000 is the number. Let's talk now to Stuart Jackson, who is, of course, former special advisor David Davis, former political Tory MP as well, now founder and director and strategic counsel at Political Insight. Stuart, very good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
Wouldn't you be ashamed if you were a woman in the Labour Party this morning, Stuart? I mean, what's wrong with Angela Rayner taking the helm when the leader isn't available?
Well, it is a little bit embarrassing from the point of view of the Labour Party, given that this is the party that extols the virtues of diversity and equality.
Yes.
We, in my party, have had two women leaders.
Right.
They can't even trust Angela Rayner on a complex issue, debating with the Prime Minister and Alok Sharma. And I think you're absolutely right. But, of course, they're peas in the pod. Keir Starmer and Ed Miliband, they're both cosmopolitan, liberal,
yeah.
North London, New Labour.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a bit of a boys' club in the Labour Party.
Yeah, you can't have a northern woman represented. You know, you can't have a woman's voice, especially if it's got a northern twang to it. I mean, I find it really... I'd be really embarrassed if I was a member of the Labour Party this morning.
It's a bit patronising. I don't see eye to eye with Angela Rayner, but I think, and she's wrong on most policy issues.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
I would say that. But she is a feisty, authentic voice of what the Labour Party used to be about in the north of England, which was representing working people. And I think if they are serious about reconnecting with those red wall seats in the northwest, in North Wales, and in the northeast, they've really got to bring forward more authentic voices that people can appreciate and people can relate to. And I don't think having a failed leader in Ed Miliband, who had all sorts of image problems and led the party to a pretty calamitous defeat in 2015.
Well, it seemed calamitous. It did seem calamitous then, until Jeremy Corbyn took over.
Well, everything's relative, Mike.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. Now, let's talk a little bit about some of the Tory rebels, because Sajid Javid was one, Theresa May was one. Quite a few Tories abstained rather than actually voting against the bill. But I seem to, I would say that it's a bit disingenuous of some of these MPs who fought on the Get Brexit Done platform and have now turned on Boris Johnson to say, well, we don't think you're doing it the right way. Well, I'm sorry. There is such a thing as sort of collective responsibility, isn't there?
There's a saying you'll know, Mike, that revenge is a dish best eaten cold.
Yeah.
And a lot of these people were either overlooked or sacked by Boris Johnson. And this is their revenge to a certain extent to cause as much mischief. I have to chuckle a little bit about the mainstream media. You know, the reporting of it last night was very much, you know, Boris suffers rebellion, Boris scrapes through. You know, a 77 majority on the second reading of a bill is not scraping through.
Right.
And even I don't think this bill will have any trouble next week, because for one simple reason is that the Conservative support in the country, people who voted Conservative in December, are solid behind this policy. Mm. They may not fully understand it, but they understand the rationale for it. And Leave voters are significantly in favour of it as well. And whilst that coalition of support can be kept behind the Prime Minister in this policy, then that's fine. And those MPs should, Conservative MPs should support it. I would also say it's getting a bit irritating to hear people who've never taken any real interest in international treaty obligations lecturing Brexiteers that this is, quote, breaking international law, unquote. It is not.
Mm.
We have a system called the dualist system. We do not give direct effect to international treaties directly the minute they're signed. We have to have domestic legislation to give legal effect to that.
Yeah.
In other words, as Gina Miller showed in 2016, it is ultimately Parliament that is sovereign and can always change a treaty in domestic law. And and that's something that these people are not conceding. And I think it's rather disingenuous.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. Because when you see somebody like, say, George Freeman, who seems to waver around like some kind of, you know, flag in the wind, you're never quite sure which way he's facing. You know, one minute he's all over us like a rash here at Talk Radio. The next minute he disappears off the face of the earth and joins some kind of miniature cabinet position. Then he's now attacking the government from outside of the tent, it would appear. I mean, I don't know what his game is.
Well, there are a lot of people that are still deeply unhappy about the decision of the British people over 4 years ago.
Mm.
and are dying in a ditch still over Brexit. To be fair to David Cameron, he wasn't taking that position. I know you did mention him amongst the five former yes. Tory leaders.
Yeah.
But I think he did take a reasonable and moderate and nuanced approach yesterday.
Yes,
he
I agree.
He didn't take the sort of slightly deranged approach that John Major constantly takes, which is that, you know, this is appalling, it's terrible for our international yeah. reputation, let's bow down and prostrate ourselves in front of the EU, which is essentially Major's point of view and Blair's.
Right.
Basically, Cameron said, well, it doesn't look particularly right, but I can kind of understand where the Prime Minister's coming from. And I think that was probably the right approach.
Yes, and he also said, by the way, this is a possible situation rather than a probable situation, and it's something that the government reserves the right to do if it decides it's necessary to do it. And it's by no means an absolute promise to do it. But the thing that made me laugh yesterday was Sky TV's coverage, right? If you were watching that, you would have thought that we were invading a country illegally or something. Oh, sorry, that was the last time Tony Blair broke international law, wasn't it? There's no real consequence. It's going to be anywhere near as bad as the result of that particular breach in this particular case.
Well, it is gilding the lily to be lectured on propriety and international treaty obligations by Tony Blair on so many different levels. I mean, he promised a referendum on a number of EU treaties. And the Lisbon Treaty in particular, and it actually never happened, of course, as we know. But, you know, the fact is, what's fundamentally at stake here is goodwill and negotiating in good faith. And when Boris signed the withdrawal agreement and enacted it in UK legislation at the beginning of this year, there was an assumption that they did want to have a free trade agreement, the EU, and that they would negotiate in good faith. But when incidentally, they have not denied this, when they infer that they will blockade Northern Ireland, they will stop goods from GB going to Northern Ireland, they will regard Northern Ireland as a de facto colony of the European Union, a part of a sovereign state that has left the EU. I think that is a serious matter that any self-respecting member of parliament needs to take notice of. And we're not going to concede that the people of Northern Ireland are, you know, a secondary UK citizenship. That is not going to happen. Mm. And we have a responsibility to keep our country united. And the other thing is, all these Tory MPs that vote against this bill and rebel next week, they're actually making no deal much more likely,
yes.
because they're cutting the legs from under the Prime Minister in his capacity to negotiate a free trade agreement by the end of October.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, watching Boris yesterday, you know, it was reassuring in a way, because it was Boris Johnson back to doing what he does best, which is, you know, a bit of bluster, a little bit of sort of, you know, fist pumping, a bit of hand shaking and all of the kind of things that he does very, very well at the dispatch box. And I just wish that he could somehow transfer that feeling that he had yesterday into the COVID problem, which I realise is a bit more difficult to solve. But at the end of the day, you know, he's being criticised at the moment by people in his own party for really not being decisive enough. And he's being very decisive when it comes to Brexit. But what can we do to make him more decisive when it comes to COVID?
Well, if you look at prime ministers over the last 20 or 30 years, every prime minister leaves office completely knackered, frankly, totally exhausted, frequently ill, although you wouldn't know about it. Whether it was Margaret Thatcher, who sadly succumbed to dementia, John Major, who I think it got very tense and he got very overwrought from time to time. Even relatively young people like David Cameron and Tony Blair were absolutely exhausted at the end.
Yeah.
This is a prime minister who is essentially facing two major crises. One is disentangling the UK from a 45-year-old relationship in good order,
right,
when the EU specifically want to make it as difficult as possible. And of course, a generational crisis, health and economic crisis we've never seen before. And on top of that, he's had a baby, or his fiance's had a baby, and he's been very close to death.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised he looks knackered, and I'm really not surprised that he's not on top form 24/7,
yeah,
because he has had so much on his plate.
No, listen, I get all that, but it's not so much about his own personal health and his own personal kind of state of affairs. It's more to do with the fact that the political decision making that he has not done over COVID has started to cause problems, not just in the country, but in the sort of the loyal electorate. The people who voted for him are telling me, if he doesn't sort this out, if he doesn't sort out immigration, doesn't sort out law and order, and doesn't sort out this COVID business, there's going to be a problem in 4 years.
Well, I agree with that, Mike, and I think a lot of Brexiteers wish him well and are still supportive, but equally I have to say that people are getting more and more annoyed about the handling of COVID. Staunch Conservatives, I do think he needs a reshuffle. I think he needs to bring perhaps some fresh blood into the cabinet.
Yeah.
He needs really to reboot the focus of the government around COVID and post-Brexit. He needs more good news stories like the Japanese free trade agreement,
yes,
that was signed last year. And he needs to bring back that sense of joie de vivre, optimism, future focus that Labour are nowhere near articulating at the moment. And you're right, if we had a more competent and credible Labour opposition and leader, he would be in a lot more trouble. But he is still level pegging or slightly heading the polls. I think if that changes, there'll be a lot more pressure on him.
Oh, I agree with that. Yeah, Keir Starmer has been absolutely hopeless. I mean, despite, again, what everybody says in the Labour Party about how great he is and about how, you know, his friends in the media talk about how brilliant he is at the dispatch box, I find him incredibly tedious, incredibly boring, uncharismatic, and completely unable to cut through any form of sort of opposition properly to the Prime Minister. But I don't know what you've heard about Prime Minister's questions tomorrow, Stuart. I'm assuming that Keir Starmer will not be able to do it. Surely it will be Angela Rayner put up for that, will it? Just to go back to our original
opening I would imagine it will be Dominic Raab versus Angela Rayner.
I'm told he might be away, though, so I'm not sure if it will be him. I think he might be in Washington.
Then I've no idea. You're putting me on the spot there.
Sorry.
It might be, but it's form for the opposites to face each other. So it wouldn't be normal for Angela Rayner to face Boris Johnson.
No,
there's a sort of I hesitate to use the term gentleman's agreement,
right,
but there's a sort of agreement between the whips that equals face off. So obviously, if Dominic's away, then it'll go to the next person, whoever that might
be. So we think it might be Rishi Sunak, in which case they might take the opportunity again to hand it to somebody else. But if they hand it to Annalise Dodds, that would be hilarious as well.
Well, she's desperately underwhelming.
She really is.
Dodds. She's not. Even Labour figures are saying that she's not landing a glove
Rishi
Sunak.
It'd be like Real Madrid taking on Woking.
Well, that's pretty accurate, I think, Mike. Yeah, Rishi Sunak obviously is being talked up very much as a future leader. I think if you're sensible, you never let that sort of comment get to you. You never develop the hubris and arrogance that, you know, it's a shoo-in, I'm going to be leader.
No.
I've not met one person who's ever said a bad thing about Rishi Sunak. Mm. He's very popular in the parliamentary party and in parliament generally. But obviously he's giving away money now. The real tough times will come when he's actually got to put taxes up,
yes,
potentially,
yeah,
if that happens, and cut public expenditure. And then his mettle will be on display as to whether he will be as popular with the parliamentary party and the wider electorate.
Absolutely right. Well, Stuart, it's going to be a fascinating week anyway. Thank you very much indeed. Stuart Jackson, former Tory MP, former special advisor to David Davis, now from Political Insight.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Let us say a very good morning to Professor Carol Sikora, one of our favourite voices on the whole COVID scenario, a man that always sounds reasonable, a man that always sounds as though he knows what he's talking about. Professor Carol, a very good morning. Welcome back.
Morning, Mike.
Thanks very much indeed for joining us. I know that you have taken a bit of time off to take some wind out of the sails of working 24/7 through the COVID pandemic. But let me ask you a question first off. I'm very unconvinced by this kind of rise in infection rates, that it's anything more than many, many more people being tested. The R rate going up is nothing more than the data which moves the R rate, because every time you go back to school, the R rate goes up. Every time you go back to the pub, the R rate goes up. What's your take on it all?
So it's the key question we're all asking. That's the question doctors, when they group together for a cup of coffee, say, what is going on? And we can't work it out. And we can't work it out because too many variables are changing all the time. On the good side, the positive side, is that the hospital admissions, whilst they've gone up slightly in certain parts of the country, have not gone up very much. And the people don't seem to be as ill. It's nothing like it was in April, when it looked as though the NHS could collapse because of everything. It's not like that.
Right.
Most people that test positive are actually asymptomatic. They have nothing at all, or they have very mild symptoms, nothing much more than flu or a bad cold.
Yeah.
So we genuinely don't know what to do. We're frightening people. The government's frightened people. This ridiculous rule of six, which is clearly made out of a committee.
Yeah.
Let's call it six. Let's do it differently in Wales. Let's have 11 as the cutoff in Scotland and 12 for the cutoff in Wales, or the other way around. I mean, it's impossible to understand the logic of the differences between it. And so they're inexplicable. I mean, you couldn't stand up in a group of scientists and say, this is my justification for this.
No.
Medical student trying to do it, you'd shout them down.
I mean, I was reading some reports the other day about France, which is now cutting down the numbers of people that can meet. And they've now cut it down to 1,000. You know, we're on six. I mean, you know, there's no comparison.
But the best one, Mike, that I heard only this morning, one of my colleagues brought it to my attention, that whilst I can't take my grandchildren to the park with their parents to play on the swings, I could take them grouse shooting, many as I like grouse shooting. Now, how ridiculous
is that? I know, absolutely unbelievable. I mean, I was watching the news last night, and the numbers of people, they had loads of people, women in groups with their children, toddlers groups, that kind of thing, being apprehended by police officers and told they got to break it up.
I know. I mean, imagine the riot squad comes, tear gas, rubber bullets, break up this children's party. I mean, it's how have we got to this? I mean, you know, patience is wearing thin with people using the full force of the law. And that, you know, I feel sorry for the police having to implement it because it's clearly ridiculous and their heart can't be in that sort of thing.
Well, I don't know. They look a bit more enthusiastic about it than I'd like to see them, to be honest.
Really? They weren't in riot gear, I hope, today.
Well, no riot gear. But here's another stat that I saw over the weekend, right? 20% apparently of all the people who are so far testing positive have actually got symptoms, which means that 80% don't.
Exactly. And this is inexplicable. Now, we know there are a lot of false positives. I mean, basically, there are only five ways you can assess people if you want the whole story. One is by taking a story from them, a history. Secondly, by temperature checking. Thirdly, by antibodies. Then by looking for PCR, the virus. And the problem with PCR, it picks up dead virus and live virus equally. Yeah. The more sensitive it is, the more chance you're picking up dead virus, which means that dead viruses causes no damage, they're not infectious and so on. And so that's the problem, it doesn't discriminate. The fifth thing is virus proteins in saliva, in the nose and so on. And that may be the way forward, but it's not developed yet. So we're sort of at the cusp of that. But as in a lot of medicine, you know, it's totally imperfect. Doctors are used to working with imperfection in their analysis as some gaps in an individual patient's workup. You're never going to solve them. You have to do it on the basis of experience and probability. We're in exactly the same place here. What's not good is the logistics. I mean, the stories of a lady near Gatwick Airport living there being sent to the Isle of Wight with her family for testing. You know, this is ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. And you think in a modern age, but they, you know, the number of civil servants involved, the number of very senior politicians involved, we'd come up with something better.
Well, this is it, because we've been obsessed with testing ever since the beginning of the lockdown, where, first of all, you know, every single day the media would be asking the question, how many tests have you managed to do today? Is it not enough? Is it 100,000? Is it 200,000? Are you sending out more than one test to more than one person? And it seems to be that they're more obsessed with the actual testing than the results of the testing and what you do with those results, because to me it doesn't matter how many people you test. If you misinterpret those results, then it's no use to anyone.
And if the test's imperfect, which it clearly is, we admit the test is not straightforward, it's not a plus minus, it's not like that, and that's the whole problem with this. But if you actually think, Mike, going forward, what are we going to do here? There's one option, is just to forget about the whole thing and say, let's relegate it to the level of a common cold or flu or something and not worry about it. The danger is the next few days will tell us if the hospital admissions don't go up significantly, and certainly hospital admissions mean there may be significant deaths if they did go up. But if they don't go up, there won't be significant deaths. And I think we just have to get back to normal life as quickly as possible. I think the government have panicked yet again, scared by a group of epidemiologists and very cautious scientific advice to say, just let's put some brakes on the social meeting. That's the rule of six and all the other things that come from it. And I think we've got to try and get out of it quickly.
Right.
And the other thing is you can go grouse shooting, you can go to the pub with as many people as you like. Sure, you can only go in a group of six, but there's nothing to stop 12 groups of six pitching up in the same pub.
Right.
So very difficult.
No, exactly right. I mean, I don't know what you make of this story. I was looking at this yesterday. Coronavirus hospital beds crisis in Marseille, apparently. Apparently close to saturation point. Now, nobody's too sure precisely what's going on there, but I don't know whether you've heard why that would be so many new infections and so many people being hospitalised.
Yeah, Marseille is a very interesting place. And the last 48 hours, there's been a real peak, a local peak in that part. France. And, you know, again, we're waiting to see what's going to happen, how seriously ill the people are, how many end up on a ventilator, which is the, you know, the chances of survival if you're put on a ventilator are around 50%. So it's clearly not a good place to go.
Right.
And so to measure the number of people in what our Department of Health call ventilatory beds, ventilation assistant beds, assisted beds, and that covers a whole range of different techniques
right.
to try and plain oxygen in people that have had COVID. So, you know, when we go back to April the 8th, which seems years ago now.
Yeah, but it does.
That was a real problem. And it looked as though intensive care beds were filling up fast. Now, intensive care.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hey, units are used for what they're meant to be, for post-operative recovery, for routine surgery. So that's good that that's the case.
Yeah, no, I mean, we've been hearing for many, many weeks now, I think, Professor, and you've been one of the people telling us that most of the COVID wards in this country are practically empty. Nobody's in them. But obviously, if that starts to change and these numbers of infections turn into hospital admissions, then I suppose we should be worried about that. But I just don't see that happening.
I don't see it happening either. But then, you know, I get shut down by my epidemiology guys. Oh, this is the second. It's like the second coming, you
right.
know, here it comes and it will swamp us over. The tsunami of COVID is coming. Yeah. You'll have to stop cancer treatment again. Stop haranguing us, Carol, that we don't want to hear about your cancer diagnostic pathways being broken. We've got a problem coming. So, you know, the next few days are critical. Just looking at the numbers, they're issued every 24 hours and they're easy to follow. Key performance indicators for hospitalization and for intensive care. And those are the critical numbers. The ministers are looking at them too, and the scientific advisors are looking at them, you know, every 24 hours. And forget what goes on in Marseille. There's bound to be a place somewhere in the world where there's a crisis. What amazes me, if you go to very high incident countries, Latin America, for example, massively high, in India, the actual hospitalizations are actually quite low.
Really?
And proportionately, the deaths are low, even in poorer parts of Latin America, such as Peru and Paraguay and so on down there, where the average income is low, the medical care is not the great at the best times. And yet they seem to be coping very well. And they don't have this psychological problem that we've developed, a project of fear, basically.
Well, that is the problem, isn't it? I've been talking to people over the course of the last, say, month or so, and indeed before that. And there was definitely a sense that confidence was returning a little bit, that schools were going to go back last week, finally, that more people might come into the cities. And that's all been knocked for six now by this rule of six.
Completely. And people don't know where to turn. And, you know, I was supposed to be the positive professor. And even I think, what is going on here? But I think we are going to get out of this somehow. And I think it's going to come sooner than we think. And I think as long as those hospital admissions don't go up, then up significantly, we're going to be fine. The most important thing is the fact, as in some of the papers today, again, the cancer and heart disease deaths will far outweigh the COVID deaths unless we get the NHS kick-started again and back into full gear.
Yeah. And I mean, I found it amusing this morning. I already pointed this out to people that The Guardian has a story that says anxiety in the UK cases have trebled in a decade. Well, is it any wonder? The Guardian spends every single day telling people how terrible life is, how terrible it's going to be. They've got another story about post-Brexit chaos on the front. And they're telling everybody they're going to die of COVID-19. I mean, no wonder people are a bit more anxious.
You know, I think the best way to get out of this, don't read the papers, don't listen to anything other than your programme.
Well, that's a very good piece of advice, Professor Carol Sakura, and very well put. But listen, let me ask you one final question. At what point does the government realise or confirm, if you like, that there is no second wave? Because it seems to me they're going to be going all the way through autumn, all the way into winter, warning that it's going to come. And if it doesn't come, say, by December, what do they do then?
They have to admit it and get things working again.
Yeah.
And, you know, what the irony is, they've driven the economy through. They've driven people getting back to work. London is busy again, or comparatively.
Well, bits of it are. Bits of it are very quiet.
Exactly. I suppose the city is still quiet.
Yeah.
People work from home. But a lot of it is getting back. Trains are getting busier, at least in London, not coming out of London. And I think once it's admitted that, you know, people aren't getting ill with the rise in infections, and a lot of it is due to the nervousness and the increased testing and the better testing that's now available, saliva testing and so on, then I think we can all move forward and get back to our normal business and everyone can begin to relax. What I find amazingly good is that the schools have gone back. I've got grandchildren and it is just amazing. And it's lovely to see. And they coping with it. Children are so malleable. They understand about the virus. They wash their hands. They're not worried about things. We are as adults. That's the problem. We've got to relax, look at the kids and be more like them.
Yes. Very good advice again. Professor Carol Sakura, thank you very much indeed. And he is, of course, former head of the WHO Cancer Programme, Dean of Medicine at the University of Buckingham as well. Two very, very excellent pieces of advice. Be more like your kids. Accept what your lot is. Do not in any way worry about what might not happen. And of course, only listen to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham and Talk Radio.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Fascinatingly, yesterday, I have to say, I think we were all stopped in our tracks when the story came out from a team of researchers at the University of Cardiff and other parts of the country that actually scientists have discovered there might well have been signs of life on Venus. Now, there's not much that we know really about Venus. We talk about Mars quite a lot. We talk about the Moon, obviously. We talk about Jupiter. We talk about Saturn's rings. I don't know much about Venus other than that it's known as like the evening star because it's one of the first things that you see in the night sky. But let's talk now to Emily Drabek-Maunder, who's an astronomer at the Royal Museums of Greenwich. Emily, a very good morning to you. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Not at all. What can you tell me about Venus? Because I feel as though I'm a bit ignorant when it comes to Venus. I don't feel like we talk about it very much.
So Venus originally was kind of known as Earth's twin or Earth's sister planet until the 1960s. And that's when we first started sending spacecraft out to the planet. But actually, Venus is incredibly hostile. We kind of found a hellish sort of landscape there. Temperatures on the surface of Venus are about 500 degrees Celsius.
Blimey.
And it has pressures high enough to crush the human body. And then on top of all of those things, it then has clouds that surround the entire planet made out of sulfuric acid. So it's not necessarily a nice place.
No, it doesn't sound very habitable, I have to say.
No, so when with our study, what we were doing is studying the clouds themselves. And so the clouds, even though they are made out of sulfuric acid, they are a little bit more hospitable. So they're slightly colder temperatures, so around 20 to 30 degrees Celsius, and they have more reasonable pressures, more similar to the Earth.
Right, okay. And as far as the discovery is concerned, the sign of life on Venus, what did you actually find?
So we found this rare gas called phosphine. And on rocky planets like the Earth, phosphine gas is directly connected to life. So it's what we call a biosignature. And specifically on the Earth, phosphine's connected to human activity through industry, as well as it's produced by microorganisms or microbes. And so it's a really exciting thing that we found phosphine gas then on another rocky planet like Venus, because it does mean life here on the Earth.
Right. So you wouldn't have expected to find it there at all. So how did you find it? How was that sort of organized? Have you sent a probe there? Have you just spotted it? How did it work?
So we actually just used ground-based radio telescopes to search for phosphine gas. So we used a telescope in Hawaii called the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope that made the initial discovery. And then we confirmed that discovery with another telescope in Chile called ALMA.
Mm. Wow. And so when you're in this kind of research group, it must be quite exciting when you suddenly fall upon something like that. What was the moment like when it was discovered?
I think with the discovery of the first detection of phosphine, everyone was kind of shocked. When we first set out to do this study, we didn't actually think we would find phosphine gas. It was, which sounds a bit strange, but actually not finding a gas in an environment in space can still be really beneficial to us. We thought we wouldn't find it and then would be able to kind of rule out some possible conditions for life in the clouds of Venus.
Okay.
But then once we found it, it was just such a big surprise and a shock. And it was just really exciting.
And is it possible to know sort of how long it's been there?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So the phosphine gas is actually destroyed after a couple of months. Mm. So something has to continuously replenish that phosphine gas that we see. And so we're not entirely sure what is behind the phosphine gas. It could be some sort of unknown chemistry or geology on the planet Venus that we just don't know about. But it could also be life up in the clouds of Venus.
Wow. And I mean, as far as Mars is concerned, when we talk about life being found there, it tends to be sort of centered around maybe droplets of water or possibly ice or something like that, or microorganisms. When you guys talk about life, you don't necessarily mean like little green men, do you?
No, absolutely not. So we're not talking about complex and intelligent beings in this case. We're talking about a more subtle form of life, like microbes or microorganisms.
Okay.
And that's one of the reasons why we have to search for gases that they might produce, because we don't see, you know, the kind of remnants of civilizations or anything like that. We're looking for something much smaller.
Okay. And so what can you do with this information? How can you sort of move it on? Is it worth sending a probe of some kind up there?
Absolutely. So in the meantime, what we can do is see if phosphine changes over time. I think that's really important. As Venus orbits the sun, it's possible that phosphine can change over time, and that can tell us something about what might be producing this phosphine, if it's life or if it's through some sort of unknown chemistry.
Right.
But in the long run, we really need to send spacecraft in order to confirm the possibility for life Venus.
And as far as other planets are concerned, are you doing similar work with those? Are you looking at those in the same way?
So we've not pursued phosphine observations with other planets, but I think that is something that really needs to be done for the future. So, for example, exoplanets are planets in other solar systems. Mm. They're outside of our solar system. And this could potentially be a really good way to, especially for rocky exoplanets like Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, if we could search for life by looking for this sort of gas.
Okay. And I said earlier that the one thing we do know about Venus is it's the evening star. Why is it that it's the one sort of planet that we can see mostly? I mean, I know sometimes you can see Mars and Venus, which is kind of cool when they're quite close to one another. But why is Venus specifically the one that we can see most?
Well, so Venus is really close to us. And so just because of how close it is to us, it's going to reflect kind of more sunlight back to the Earth. And so that's why we can see it. Now we can see Venus in the early morning, just before sunrise. But you also have quite a few other planets to choose from in the evening. So we can also see Saturn, Jupiter, and Mars right now in the evening.
Oh, wow, really? I mean, with the naked eye or need a telescope?
No, don't need a telescope. You can just go outside and look up and you'll be able to spot
them. I must do that the weekend because I won't be in the city. So in the city, it's always difficult. And it's very hazy looking out there at the moment. I'm seeing vaguely making out the roof of the Tower of London because it's so hazy. But I'll be looking out for all of that. But that's fascinating stuff. And you must feel very, does this put you into the kind of first division of scientists now that you've made this discovery?
Yeah, it's just been a really exciting time. I think it's taken the entire team. It's caught us a bit off guard, but I think it's just an exciting time for everyone, and we've had lots of really good feedback. So hopefully the entire scientific community will start really considering Venus as a possibility for life.
Wow, great stuff. Emily, thank you very much indeed. Emily Drobeck-Maunder, astronomer at Royal Museums Greenwich, co-author of the research, co-discoverer of the research as well. It's on the front page of the Times this morning. Forget Mars, scientists find a sign of life on Venus. How exciting. I can't wait to start looking out for Saturn. I didn't know you could see that. I wonder if you see the rings as well.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
So a nation has basically turned to drink, according to this study. Britain turns to drink, front page of the Daily Mail. Number Downing, high-risk levels doubles during pandemic, and the middle class are the worst offenders. Let's talk to Professor Sir Ian Gilmore, Chair of the Alcohol Health Alliance, to find out what he makes of it all. Professor Sir Ian, a very good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Mike.
Thanks very much indeed for joining us. I mean, we've always had a bit of a problem in this country with alcohol. I don't know whether it's getting worse, you might be able to tell me, or whether we've always had the problem.
I think we've always had problems. We've always tended to be a binge drinking culture compared to many other societies, like Southern European countries who tend to be tipplers. We tend to be bingers. Mm. And we're certainly seeing harm rise over the last couple of decades. I mean, hospital admissions from alcohol are really at an all-time high at the moment, at a time when we can least afford it because of COVID.
Yeah. I mean, interesting that I don't know whether you've seen the actual quiz that's in the Daily Mail or whether it was inspired by this particular study. But one of the things that they ask is, during the past year, have you been unable to remember what happened the night before because you've been drinking? I'm glad I was able to answer never to that. During the past year, how often have you had a feeling of guilt or remorse after drinking? I was also able to say never to that. Have you or someone else ever been injured as a result of your drinking? So, I mean, it's interesting that, those are the kinds of questions that people are now being asked.
I mean, I think they're very pertinent questions, and they certainly relate to whether someone is at risk of alcohol dependence. I mean, there are, you know, there are 1.5 million dependent drinkers in the country, and they're a huge burden in terms of you know, loss of time from work, using up health service time, and particularly now, it is the strain on the health service.
Mm. And what do you think the reason is? I realise this is probably a very wide-ranging question and a possibly even wider-ranging answer, but why do you think it is that British people are so kind of interested in drinking?
Well, as you say, it is a long-standing culture, but culture can be changed by quite simple measures. For example, if you go back 10 years, most alcohol was drunk in pubs and bars. Now, 80% of all drinks except beer is drunk at home.
Yeah.
And that's been driven by cheap supermarket drink. It used to be more expensive to buy a bottle of beer and take it home from the pub than it was to buy it in the pub.
Right.
Now, people say, why should I spend £6-7 on a drink when I can get the whole bottle
right
next door and take it home?
Mm.
So you can change culture by regulatory measures. But also, I think we do need to all just look at ourselves. There's hardly a family that's not been touched by the impact of alcohol harm. We've just done a commission on alcohol harm, and we've listened to the stories from individuals, families, particularly children brought up by alcohol-dependent parents. Those children are twice as likely to be dependent on alcohol themselves in later life. They're more likely to have mental health issues. They're more likely to commit suicide. So as a society, I think we need to try and move away from this normalization of alcohol, where it's in the middle of every celebration and where people feel uncomfortable if they decide not to drink.
Well, one of the things that we all wrestle with teenage kids, for example, of which I have two, is whether you let them drink or not. And you know, I remember, I think I had my first drink when I was about 14. I was working in a place where the owner of the bakery where I worked would drink beer in the afternoon, and he would give me a beer. You know, I didn't think there was any harm in it, really. But you might see others would say, well, that's horrendous. What were you drinking at the age of 14? I've now got a 16-year-old son who we occasionally allow to have a beer.
It is a difficult problem, and you know, and I sympathise with parents, and there is this idea that if you introduce children to alcohol younger in the home in a controlled environment, then the outlook will be better. Unfortunately, the facts do not support that. And the evidence really points to the fact that the earlier children start drinking, and the more they drink when they start, the more likely they are to have alcohol problems in the future.
Yes. And I suppose there's peer pressure presumably on them as well. I mean, I think there's some parents who are thankful that they're just drinking the odd beer rather than smoking dope or something, you know?
But yes, there is that to it. And there's certain, you know, I think people look at the French and say, oh, yes, they give them watered down wine at the age of 11, 12. And look,
Spanish
they have
as well.
Yes, that's right. But the evidence at the moment does not support that. And that the chief medical officer's advice is not to give children alcohol before the age of 16. But in that context, probably in the family environment is better. But I think the most important thing is that children don't listen to what their parents say. They watch what their parents do.
Yes.
And too many parents are saying, don't go out and get drunk, when they're already tipsy themselves at home.
Well, that's the problem. I mean, do you also wonder, because we talk about food quite a lot in this country now and obesity, and I wonder whether the availability is an issue as well. Because when I was growing up quite a few years ago, you know, there wasn't the same amount of alcohol on show and certainly on sale as there is now. You don't more or less have to go to an off license, whereby you would have to kind of look through what looked like a rather sort of curious collection of bottles to buy whatever it was you were buying. Now, you walk into a supermarket and quite often there's wine sort of front and centre as you walk in boxes, being offered on sale.
Absolutely. And we, you know, we're one of the most liberal countries in that respect. Most countries would have alcohol in a separate section, often having to go to a separate till. Whereas in and even now in Scotland and in the Republic of Ireland, that you have to have alcohol in a separate area. You can't have a big special offer as you walk into the store. So, you know, and look at France. There's a complete ban on broadcast advertising of alcohol. There's a ban on sports sponsorship by alcohol companies. Whereas, you know, we're bombarded by alcohol adverts in this country. And they're on social media. Children have access to them.
And as far as the, say, the Scottish situation goes, which you mentioned, they started this minimum pricing of alcohol. It seems to be mixed as to whether people think that's a success or not.
I think it is probably too early to know, because the final analysis will be what happens to the harm that people suffer. But preliminary evidence is on the whole supportive. We've also got it's underway in Wales. It's going to get underway in the Republic of Ireland. North of Ireland is interested. The UK government in Westminster need to have a proper alcohol strategy. They've dodged it since 2012. They put it in the too difficult box. The drinks industry is too powerful. Until they sit down and really look at the cost of alcohol, the economic cost of alcohol, not just to the health service, to law and order, and many other things, loss of time from work.
Yeah.
It would be an investment to put a bit of money into an alcohol strategy.
Well, it would, but of course, the drinks industry, I suppose, would argue that they make an awful lot of money for the government. They generate an awful lot of tax. They also employ an awful lot of people. The whole hospitality business that we've heard so much about in recent times is kind of being knocked over by the lack of people going out. But yet, the sales of drink haven't gone down.
But let's have a proper argument. Let's have a proper discussion with government. Let's look at the figures. My understanding is that actually if we could ease back on the nation's consumption, it would save money rather than lose money.
Yes, indeed. So, what would you like to see a government policy here, Sir Ian?
Well, I think the first thing I'd like to see is a proper alcohol strategy using evidence-based methods. We know that the three big drivers of how much we drink and how much harm we see are price, availability, and marketing. You've highlighted some of those very well yourself. We need to address those, but there's also the support for people who are already in trouble. The problem is that so many of these treatment services have been farmed out to third sector and private providers, going to the cheapest tender. It's a very soft underbelly where money is short in local authorities to cut back on treatment services. And we know that actually money spent in treatment services, again, saves money. It stops to stop these revolving door patients going in and out of hospital if they can be managed properly and helped. And these people deserve help. I mean, alcohol dependence is an illness. There's a strong genetic component to it. You often find it runs to a degree in families. It's very easy to think this is somebody else's problem. But actually, as I said earlier, there's hardly a family that hasn't been touched by alcohol at harm in some way.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. And in a way, because of all of those things that you mentioned, it makes it even more surprising, I suppose, that, that the consumption levels haven't gone down.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are some encouraging signs, and one is that young people seem to be drinking less than they did perhaps 10 years ago. But I think a major concern is the drinking habits of the middle age and older.
Yeah.
Where often they're less able to tolerate the alcohol. They often have other illnesses. They're often on medication. You know, I remember an intensive care specialist telling me the problems they have with elderly people falling downstairs at night and sustaining head injuries right. when they've had one too many.
Yes, it's quite an extraordinary state of affairs, really. But, I mean, I can't see it changing, I have to say. I mean, I don't know whether any of those measures might work. But I really, I mean, I just think our relationship with drinking in this country is so kind of endemic and it, and is so kind of traditional almost that, that it's hard to imagine it changing, really.
Well, I'm not so pessimistic as that. And I think if you know, I mean, how many health warnings have you seen about alcohol on the television? I mean, you know, most people are totally unaware of any problems from alcohol to their health, except possibly people know about cirrhosis of the liver. Mm. Very few people know that there's a strong link to several common cancers like colon cancer, breast cancer. Women who drink are more likely to get breast cancer. Not many women know that.
It does feel to me that, like before COVID, the General Medical Council and the Chief Medical Officers were quite often issuing sort of edicts about, you know, you shouldn't drink more than one glass of wine a week, or you shouldn't have more than this many units, or, you know, one glass of wine, which is red, might be okay. I mean, they used to talk about it quite a lot.
Well, yes, absolutely. And, you know, there were new guidelines brought out by the Chief Medical Officers of the UK in, I think it was 2016, those are still not on the majority of labels. The drinks industry undertook to put these things on drinks labels. They palpably failed to do that, and it needs regulation. We know that it's not in the drinks industry interests to roll over and tell people about the harms of alcohol. We need the government to do it for them.
No, quite. Well, listen, I dare say that everyone will be filling out their Daily Mail questionnaire here and seeing how problematic their drinking is. Professor Cyrene Gilmore, Chairman of the Alcohol Health Alliance, thank you very much indeed. Let's take some calls on that, 0344 499 1000. I mean, I would say anyone who is a relatively moderate drinker would fill out this form and would score over the odds, which is 8 points, which means you are either drinking harmfully or hazardously. That's what it means. I think most people in Britain would probably be in that particular category. Not necessarily dependent, which is the next one up, but certainly hazardous, according to this. But, you know, only you can tell whether or not your drinking is dangerous.
Talk Radio. Across the UK. Online. On DAB. And on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. On Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday on Talk Radio via DAB online or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.